Meanwhile, local support for the Bessemer Union is strong. Nearly two-thirds of residents in Jefferson County, Alabama, say they support a union at the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer. A survey of 1,000 county residents released recently found that 62% supported a union at the warehouse, including 78% of black respondents and 79% of black women. About 85% of the Amazon warehouse's employees are black, and black workers are leading the union drive, according to the Institute for Policy Studies, a think tank that commissioned the survey. The survey released recently included broader questions about economic and social justice issues, along with questions about the union drive at the Amazon warehouse, a major employer in the area. The labor movement has traditionally struggled to build popular support and win union elections in the South compared to other regions, but nearly 50% of white respondents said they support a union at the massive Amazon warehouse. Mark Bayard, director of the Black Worker Initiative at the Institute for Policy Studies, said, "Even in the heart of the right-to-work U.S. South, there is amazing potential for an energized and revitalized labor movement to score major victories and improve the lives of Alabama workers." This survey shows that local community members stand with unionization efforts at Amazon facilities in Jefferson County, despite misinformation campaigns. Workers at Bessemer Warehouse can cast ballots in the current union election until late March. If enough workers vote to join the union, the warehouse will be the first Amazon facility to unionize in the country, potentially setting the stage for others to follow. Lipman added, "What's Amazon afraid of?"
Egypt's prisons, it's not strange for Israel, nor America, nor some European nations that are colonialist to enlist some of the Palestinian resistance factions on their terrorist organizations' lists. But it is very strange for some Arab countries to join these nations' efforts that are aimed at eliminating the Palestinian resistance by all means.
Thank President Hosni Mubarak for his leadership and his understanding of the situation, and also to thank the President of the United States, George W. Bush, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, for their endless efforts throughout the last 3 weeks in order to protect the right of Israel for self-defense against terrorist activities, and at the same time to help create the necessary international environment that will bring an end to hostilities while guaranteeing the right of Israel to defend itself against any aggression perpetrated by terrorist organizations from whichever direction.
Olmert's gratitude to Mubarak was not a result of nothing, but it was due to something. It was due to something between them, something that can be uncovered to us by Hossam Washah from Al Buraij refugee camp in central Gaza. This 27-year-old youth was arrested by the Egyptian authorities, then transferred to one of the interrogation centers in the town of Al Arish.
I was arrested along with an elderly man who's still in jail in Egypt. I was taken to Al Arish and then to Al Yadhiqli in Cairo. I was held by the National Security Forces. I received horrible treatment, interrogation, torture, and humiliation from the Egyptian National Security and intelligence services.
(laughs) Ayman Nofel, 35, entered Egypt in the beginning of 2008 when thousands of Palestinians opened holes in the security fence between Gaza and Egypt, seeking to get urgent necessities lacking due to the shocking siege.
I was arrested on the 27th of January 2008 on my way to Al Arish. I entered like everyone else. I was looking to buy necessities. It was during the days when the fence between Gaza and Egypt was penetrated. I was arrested inside Al Arish city. The police pulled me over and found handguns with the other two guys in the same car. So we were transferred to Sector 4, and an hour later I was handed over to the National Security Agency.
Ramzi Al-Rai, a young man from Rafah, south of Gaza, was injured by an Israeli bullet and a tank shell fragment in 2004. He continued to suffer from the injury until 2010, when the Egyptian authorities allowed him to enter Egypt for treatment.
I got in around March 2010. I was injured during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. I had tank shell shrapnel in my body. I managed to get a permit for medical treatment in Egypt because I'd been advised to get shrapnel fragments removed, and that treatment was safer and better in Egypt. I booked a room at a hotel after arriving. After about 15 minutes, my room was raided. They threw me to the floor, handcuffed me, and began searching me and the room. I told them, "Why are you searching me? I have nothing. I'm here to get treatment." They said it was a security procedure. Then they took me outside and told me they would need me for only 5 minutes.
Mohammed Al-Hashim lives in northern Gaza. After the end of the war on Gaza in 2009, he and some of his friends decided to go perform the Umrah in Mecca through crossing Egyptian territories.
After living under siege for a long time, we really miss traveling abroad. So we registered for Umrah along with hundreds of others. Just like anyone else, we wanted to perform the Umrah in Saudi Arabia. We were a group included several that had injuries from war on Gaza. We went to Syria, where some got treatment and some others went to Iran for same purpose. We spent 11 months abroad awaiting permission to return home, but to no avail. We tried Egypt Air, but they rejected us. So we decided to fly Saudi Air. When we got off the plane in Cairo, they arrested us as soon as they saw our passports. Then they took us to the National Security Center.
The ceremony of this reception in Egypt went as follows.
I did not expect a strip search. After they strip searched me, I put my clothes back on. Then they brought me bread and cheese. I told them I wasn't hungry. The officer left the room. I thought he was going to bring a supervisor, but suddenly I felt a strong stinging sensation all over my body. They were electrocuting me. They used it on my head, back, and side. They said, "We told you, you will eat. Anyone who refused to eat got electrocuted."
As for Hassan Washah, his reception in the interrogation and torture center included insults, beatings, and other torture methods.
The intelligence services handed me to the National Security Agency. I'd already been tortured by the intelligence agents, but they did it to me again at the National Security Agency. For days, I was beaten, tortured, and humiliated.
Nofel was not one of the lucky Qassam fighters' leaders in the treatment he got, despite the fact that the Egyptian security forces were aware that he is a leader in the Palestinian resistance and is wanted by the Israeli occupation.
They used beatings, fists, blindfolding, handcuffing, humiliation, and insults. They would threaten me, saying, "If you don't confess, we will undress you, and give you an electric shock. They didn't, but I wish they would, because it would have been easier to tolerate than watching all those young men get electrocuted.
After 3 days, they began serious interrogation with me, which meant being stripped naked, tied to a metal bed, tied at the feet, with legs separated apart so that, as you can imagine, they would be able to electrocute me anywhere they could, like in the ears, tongue, and privates. They would rub a diesel fuel-soaked cloth on the body, which caused burn marks on the skin when electrocuted. It felt like your skin was on fire. Those torture sessions would last 1 or 2 hours.
The torture of Palestinian resistors behind the wall of Egypt's national security centers condemns Mubarak's former regime and proves it was connected to foreign intelligence services.
The arrest had definitely been ordered by Israel because of all the questions. They would ask, what is the structure of resistance? What kind of preparations have they made? How far can the rockets go? What kind of explosives and weapons do they possess? All those questions had something to do with Israel and didn't mean to harm Egypt in any way. The interrogator once told me, in 2004, you were part of a resistance mission in Israel. I answered, if I did something to the Jews, then why am I in prison in Egypt? You should thank me. The officer answered, my son, if we, in national security, could, we would burn Gaza.
It's not natural. You would feel that he is a Jew, like an Israeli interrogating you. Due to his intensive concern about Israel's security, you would feel that he is not a Muslim nor Arab. He does not have even the slightest bit of the Arab race in him. His questions include, did the Jews harm? All this that you see on TV, and he is asking me if the Jews harmed me? Did they personally harm you? I answered him, do they have to enter our house and kill my brother? So he asked again, so did they kill your brother or father, or torture you, or imprison you or your father? I answered him, so it has to come on my head. They occupied and stole my land, and murdered my people, and killed and disfigured us. And you are asking me if they harmed me?
According to Muhammad al-Hashim, torture methods were numerous and had a purpose. He never expected himself to face terror charges in an Arab country because he is a resistor of the Israeli occupation.
We felt that those in national security and Egyptian security forces were looking for something. They always tried to get as much information as they could to serve Israel and America. For 30 years, that regime supported and protected Israel at the expense of humiliating Palestinians. It made them feel lost and worthless. The Americans paid the Egyptians $20 a day to keep in jail anyone who tried to harm Israel. Anyone, an alleged jihadist or a resistance fighter.
It was like the Israeli agents' interrogation style. While I was there, I felt like I was sitting in the interrogation rooms inside the Al-Magdal prison in Israel. They wanted information, and all their questions were focused on the resistance weapons, the structure of the Al-Qassam brigades, the range of missiles they had, and how Shalit was kidnapped and kept in captivity. Let's say all this was during the first month. After that, I was kept as a hostage to blackmail Hamas.
When torturing Palestinian resistors does not bring any results, they are thrown in Egypt's prisons in an attempt to make them hopeless so that they might give out information that can help the Egyptian security forces aid the Israeli occupation.
For 24 months, I was alone and isolated in Al-Marq prison in the district of Al-Golubiya next to Cairo. As a human being, I was concerned about the information I had and how I could withhold it, especially information about the resistance weapons and the Shalit issue. Speaking about these issues is very difficult. It's better to die a martyr than whisper about these issues. I thought of two scenarios on how to get released. Either Mubarak dies or Shalit is released. We had strong faith in God. The Egyptian revolution succeeded after Mubarak was removed. We hoped that after this toppling, we would be released from prison.
Ayman was detained in the corridors of Egypt's prisons along with 10 members of Al-Qassam fighters as part of a scheme to blackmail the Hamas movement. As for Muhammad al-Hashim, he was released after a 10-month journey of torture.
The Islamic Jihad leadership received the message saying their prisoners had been released. The situation in Egypt was very dangerous, so they moved us quickly. In July 2010, we were moved from Al-Kanater prison directly to the Rafah border crossing, and from there to the Palestinian side of the border. Thank God.
After a long suffering, Muhammad al-Hashim arrived in Gaza. As for Hassan Washah, he was transferred from Al-Arish prison to Abu Zabal prison in Cairo.
Abu Zab prison is known around the world. I never thought that one day I'd be held in there. It's a well-guarded prison. I was in my cell 24 hours a day and not allowed to go out. I was placed with criminals convicted of stealing, murder, and selling drugs. Even though you are a political prisoner, they surround you with criminals to humiliate you.
Hassan might spend years or even his entire life in one of the worst prisons in Egypt with criminal convicts. As for Ramzi, the Egyptian interrogators are still making him taste the worst types of torture.
Suddenly he said to me, "Look, I will give you something you never saw before. Today I will break you. I pleaded, please have mercy. I will tell you whatever you want to hear. Look, so far I have managed to stand all the torture, including electrocution. At this stage, I told him, just get me a nice piece of paper, and I will write all they wanted to know and sign it. He was surprised and told me to sit down. I started to sit, but I felt something was underneath me. Then someone hit me in the head, and I plunged down. I suddenly felt a burning electrical current run through my body. I was being electrocuted from the inside. It was nothing like the other type of electrocution. I cannot even begin to describe the pain. Honestly, it's inexplicable." The next day he asked me, "Are you mocking me? You say you will talk when things get serious, but then you don't." I said, "I wanted to tell you to please have mercy on me." Once again, he sat me on the electric chair like it wasn't enough to get electrocuted through the rectum once. When they transferred me to Abu Zab prison, I felt like a ball of blood with long hair and nails. My fellow brethren were shocked. They cleaned me up. My journey of suffering and ill treatment came to an end.
Ramzi's goal in Egypt was to get treatment for the wounds he had sustained at the hands of the Israeli occupation army. But the interrogation and torture he received in Egypt added to his wounds in ways he never imagined.
We hope that the Egyptian army would take a serious humanitarian look at the circumstances and case of Ramzi Arai, because his health is in a very bad situation, and he has never been proven to be criminal, nor have done anything bad to Egypt.
After the passing of 1 year for Ramzi in Egyptian prisons, and 3.5 years for Ayman and Hassan Washa, the promise of the January 25th revolution began to loom in the horizon, which reignited hope for the tens of millions that awaited for it for too many years. This Arabian revolution came to change an abusive, merciless regime that inflicted on Egyptian and those around them the worst types of torture, a regime that turned Egypt from the beating heart of the Arab and Islamic world to an economically, politically, and socially poor nation.
We heard gunfire in the afternoon of the 29th. They closed up Abu Zab prison. We felt there is something going on. The TV showed there was trouble outside. There was regular gunfire. The prisoners began breaking the doors and heading for freedom. Some were killed or injured. The prisoners' families helped us. And along the way, we didn't encounter one single roadblock.
On Saturday, we heard that Abu Zabl prisoners had gotten out. At 8 a.m. Sunday, January 30th, we broke down the doors and got out of prison. We walked near family homes where we met a nice-looking man. We explained to him we were Palestinian resistance fighters who had been imprisoned by the evil Mubarak regime. The man sympathized with us and let us use his phone. He also helped us get a car. We stayed at his house and moved from house to house until we reached Gaza.
Around the beginning of the Egyptian Revolution on January 29th, Hassan arrived in Gaza as the first Palestinian liberated from Egyptian prisons. And 3 days after him, Nofal arrived home to his family. As for the family of Ramzi Al-Ra, they were the last to meet him. Luckily, for them, time passed quickly.
We were waiting for his return, so my sons went to receive him, and they were quite ready to receive their father, but there was no destiny yet. Of course, he was in the prison like all other prisoners. They were surprised of the groups of people raiding the prison, breaking the walls and doors, liberating the prisoners. He was also liberated.
The doors of prison opened and armed men entered. They clashed with the government forces inside. And before we knew it, we were on the streets not knowing where to go until a car took us to the Ismailia area, and from there we headed to Al-Arish. As luck would have it, we were captured by the army. We thought it was going to be prison and torture again. They asked us what we were doing there. Then they transferred us by military planes to Al-Aqraba prison.
Ramzi did not have to stay in prison for too long, because after the collapse of the Mubarak regime, he was released and returned home to reunite with his family.
I was in jail for exactly 10 days. I had a release order, so I was released. I was very happy to be free. It felt like a dream to be out and on the way home. When I arrived in Palestine, I could not believe my eyes. I knelt down and kissed the ground. Then I met my friends, my family, and my mother. I felt like I had been born again.
We'll be right back.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. George Floyd's murder set in motion shockwaves that touched almost every aspect of American society. But under core issues of police violence and police accountability, very little is different. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Tim Arango and Julia Hayward. The piece is titled, Despite Uproar Over Floyd's Death, the Number of Fatal Encounters with Police Hasn't Changed. For a second time this year, a jury in Minneapolis has ruled against a former police officer for killing a black man. Like the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, the verdict on Thursday, 23rd of December, against Kimberly Potter on two counts of manslaughter for the shooting death of Daunte Wright during a traffic stop represented an unusual decision to send a police officer to prison. And yet, despite the two high-profile convictions in Minneapolis, a review of the data a year and a half after America's summer of protest shows that accountability for police officers who kill remains elusive, and that the sheer numbers of people killed in encounters with police have remained steady at an alarming level. The murder of George Floyd on a Minneapolis street corner drew millions to the streets in protest and set off a national reassessment on race that touches almost every aspect of American life, from corporate boardrooms to sports nicknames. But under core issues that set off the social unrest in the first place, that is police violence and police accountability, very little has changed. Since Mr. Floyd's death in May of last year, 1,646 people have been killed by the police, or about 3 people per day on average, according to Mapping Police Violence, a non-profit organization that tracks people killed by the police. Although murder or manslaughter charges against police officers have increased this year, criminal charges, much less convictions, remain exceptionally rare. That underscores both the benefit of the doubt usually accorded law officers who are often making life or death decisions in a split second, and the way the law and the power of police unions often protect officers, say activists and legal experts. The convictions of both Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was captured on an excruciating bystander video pinning George Floyd to the ground for more than 9 minutes as he gasped for air, and Kimberly Potter, strike some experts as tantalizing glimpses of a legal system in flux. Kimberly Ponta's case in particular reflected the kind of split-second decision. She mistakenly used her gun instead of her taser after Daunte Wright tried to flee an arrest that jurors usually excuse even when something goes horribly wrong. Chris Uggan, a sociology and law professor at the University of Minnesota, said that even though the number of people killed by police remained prevalent, high-profile cases could still send a message to the police. The probability of punishment is not zero, he said, so it moves the needle to some degree, and it can certainly affect the behaviors of police officers. But many experts are reluctant to read too much into a few isolated cases carried out in the glare of media scrutiny. Criminal trials are not designed to be instruments of change, said Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former prosecutor. Criminal trials are about bringing individual wrongdoers to justice, so while there have been high-profile prosecutions of police officers for killing black people, that doesn't in and of itself lead to the kind of systematic reform that might reduce police violence. Philip Stinson, a criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who tracks police criminal charges and convictions, said Kimberly Potter was the first female police officer convicted of a murder or manslaughter charge in an on-duty shooting incident since 2005. He said he believed that the number of deaths from excessive police force was higher than what was recorded and reflected in news coverage. Many police officers exhibit a fear of black people, he said. Until we can address that, it is very difficult to bring about meaningful reforms. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, a constitutional law professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, said accountability also needed to be aimed at prosecutors who gave police officers carte blanche for a century until the recent show of public outrage. Change is not likely to come anytime soon, she said. In these individual cases, justice won in the end, she said, but there is a lot of work that still needs to be done. Jim Pascoe, the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police, said the rarity of criminal charges against police officers doesn't indicate a lack of accountability, but simply reflects that the vast majority of police shootings are lawful, with many occurring under dangerous circumstances where police officers have to make quick life or death decisions. There has been no finding of fault against police officers in many of the other recent high-profile cases of people killed in encounters with the police. Less than 3 weeks after the murder of George Floyd, an officer in Atlanta, Georgia, fatally shot a black man named Rayshard Brooks, who was fleeing a Wendy's parking lot after taking a taser from the officer's partner and firing it at him. The killing in Atlanta, Georgia, like that of George Floyd's, was captured on bystander video and drew protesters, adding to the demands for justice and accountability over the number of African Americans killed by the police. And about 2 months before George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor was killed in her Louisville apartment during a botched police raid that targeted an ex-boyfriend for alleged drug crimes. Her name, too, became familiar to millions of Americans. Yet the police officers involved in the Breonna Taylor case have largely been cleared, even as federal authorities continue to investigate. And in Atlanta, Georgia, Rayshard Brooks's case stalled this summer as it was passed to a third prosecutor, who is starting the investigation all over again. The police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks has been charged with murder, but there is no timeline for a trial. "We are taking a fresh look at it and starting from day one," said Pete Skandalakis, a special prosecutor in Georgia who took over the case. He added that he could not predict when the case would see a courtroom. That has left Rayshard Brooks's family wondering if they will ever see justice. "I think we're all just lost right now," said Chris Stewart, a lawyer who represents the Brooks family. "We don't know what to think or what's going on." According to data kept by Philip Stinson and a research team at Bowling Green University in Ohio, 21 police officers this year have been charged with murder or manslaughter for an on-duty shooting, although 5 of the officers charged are for the same encounter, the killing in November of 2020 of a 15-year-old boy who was a suspect in an armed robbery. While this is an increase from the 16 police officers charged in 2020 and the highest number since Philip Stinton began compiling the data since 2005, it remains small next to the roughly 1,100 people killed by the police annually. Just as the pace of killing since George Floyd's death has remained largely unchanged, racial disparities have also stayed the same. Black people are still 2.5 to 3 times as likely as white people to be killed by a police officer, according to Mapping Police Violence. While Derek Chauvin's trial was underway in the spring, Daunte Wright's death at the hands of Kimberly Potter in Brooklyn Center, a Minneapolis suburb, set off new rounds of protests in the Twin Cities. And in the rest of America, the number of new cases of people killed in encounters with the police continued apace, some of them piercing the national consciousness and adding to the names protesters shouted in the streets. Among them were Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino teenage boy who was killed by a Chicago police officer after running down a dark alleyway with a gun. And in Columbus, Ohio, shortly before the jury reached a decision in the Derek Chauvin trial, a 16-year-old black girl named Marcia Bryant was shot to death by an officer as she swung a knife at a young woman. A state agency investigated Marcia's death and in July turned its findings over to local prosecutors in Franklin County. At the time, the state attorney general said he expected it to take prosecutors several weeks to make a charging decision. But a spokeswoman for Gary Tyack, a county's top prosecutor, said the case was still under review 5 months later. More recently, at a high school football game in a suburb of Pennsylvania this fall, police officers opened fire amid a crowd after they heard gunshots, killing an 8-year-old black girl named Fanta Belitti. All of these cases remain under investigation, and no charges have been filed against the police officers involved. One of the reasons for Derek Chauvin's conviction was that the circumstances of the case differed so starkly from so many other cases in which police officers were cleared by prosecutors or by juries. There was no split-second decision made in an environment in which Derek Chauvin could argue that his life or those of other police officers was in danger. In the trial of Kimberly Potter, which played out in the same courtroom where Derek Chauvin was tried, her defense lawyers said Kimberly Potter acted reasonably in using force because she feared for the life of a fellow police officer, a scenario more emblematic of a typical police killing case. This time, though, that argument did not work.
32.
2만.
2만.
32. Archaeologists discovered one of the oldest medical devices dating back 9,000 years ago. The device is a flint-tipped drill and bowstrings used by Neolithic dentists in the Balochistan area of Pakistan. Nowadays, medical devices are far more advanced but carry the same importance in healthcare. Innovative products can replace, repair, and sustain failing body functions. These items can also have intelligence that allows health practitioners to remotely monitor a patient's conditions. Today, thanks to technology, there are more accessible treatments for a wide variety of diseases with more efficient care for the sick person.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connects us nationally and internationally. This time, we're going to check out the contributions of knowledge-based companies to the health sector. We wanted to see what types of products are made, plus we will briefly touch on what goes into making medical devices that save the lives of people, especially during the pandemic. Let's start the show. To familiarize ourselves with medical device production, we visited a knowledge-based company that specializes in making advanced technology for hospitals and clinics. Puyandegone Rahe Saadat was first established nearly 3 decades ago and has been actively producing products in 7 categories. Its products are used to monitor health or treat critically ill patients in hospitals. Among its achievements, one can name the 247 plan in collaboration with the Ministry of Health. This was a program that connects ambulances carrying patients to hospital emergency rooms. This knowledge-based company designed a portable cardiograph machine that is carried on ambulances. The advantage of these devices is they can save sensitive heart images. The information is sent directly to the emergency room for analysis as the patient is on their way. Plus, the device can receive calls and medical doctors can speak with patients and provide on-the-spot instructions. Such a system has saved thousands of lives. The research and development department holds the pulse of this company. Here, quality control checks are carried and standardization criteria are implemented. It is also where new products are born. Among its hundreds of employees, this company uses the knowledge and expertise of a slew of various engineers to make advanced products from seemingly simple ideas. Medical devices are a fundamental part of healthcare systems. They are essential to prevent, diagnose, treat, and rehabilitate illnesses and diseases safely and effectively. Because they deal with human life, these items need to always be dependable, safe, and accurate with zero failure. That is why medical devices must follow extremely strict standards for production and also performance.
Some 20 years ago, this company obtained EU standardization licenses and has since produced its products along with European standards. It also adheres to the strict requirements of the Ministry of Health and the National Medical Device Directorate. This company has massive production halls that are closely monitored. The processes of quality control checks are taken very seriously as these tests ensure the high quality of products made in this place.
Each component of any device is checked for quality before it is even applied. All stages of production are continuously examined and tested to ensure the final assembly produces the best outcome. But that's not where quality control stops. The final products are also tested and examined for accurate performance. It might be interesting to know that this company has been exporting its products to dozens of countries around the globe. This knowledge-based business has never stopped looking to the future. As part of its vision, it plans to develop its products to increase its capabilities and diversity. Moreover, it plans on increasing its export reach. As with any business when starting out, there are always challenges to overcome, and one of the hurdles for this company was the U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. But instead of allowing the sanctions to become a thorn in its side, this company turned it into an opportunity for growth. Over the past two decades, Iran has taken huge strides in the health and medical sector. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing at a rate that is above the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 of its medical devices to show for it. This technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced machinery used in the medical sector. Out of the 1,000 medical device manufacturers in the country, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These manufacturers generate some 30% of revenues in medical device market. That's based on statistics from the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology of Iran. Going off the figures from the Medical Equipment Office at the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced in the country. All of these products meet EU standardization requirements. To get a better idea of just how advanced this sector really is, we looked at some data from the National Medical Device Directorate. Figures showed that over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions. Domestic medical device production has developed by leaps and bounds since 2019. Productions have reduced imports by 10%. Meanwhile, exports of these items have also increased by 10% over the last 3 years. These figures come from the Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health. The National Medical Device Directorate said Iran's medical device productions were worth nearly $3 billion in 2018. Current official figures have not been made public yet, but industry participants predict Iran's share of this market will be roughly $7 billion by 2025. The significant progress in medical device production has been largely due to government support for manufacturers and knowledge-based companies. Knowledge-based companies are peeling away the fingers of the U.S. monopoly on medical equipment and pharmaceuticals by manufacturing sanctioned items. Doing so has reduced imports and saved the country large amounts of foreign currency while meeting domestic needs. The U.S. government claims that the sanctions do not include medicine and medical equipment. But sanctions have made it virtually impossible for Iran to import vital medicine and medical devices. During tough times, at the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the Ministry of Health turned to knowledge-based companies for much-needed innovations to save people's lives. Companies, like the one we mentioned earlier, stepped up to the plate and began manufacturing items like ventilators. Since the beginning of the outbreak, domestic firms have been making testing kits, vaccines, medicine, and other strategic products. Currently, 5 coronavirus vaccines have been domestically manufactured, all of which have completed required clinical trials and are offered to the public after being approved by the Health Ministry. Iran is one of the few countries in the world that has the capabilities to produce vaccines. Not only has Iran fully met the country's needs, but it also has the capacity to export COVID-19-related treatments and testing products. Historically, each epoch has a particular industrial growth spurt. At present, what we are witnessing is another industrial shift but this time it is towards knowledge-based products. These items have allowed several processes in our lives and industries to become faster and more efficient. For example, medical devices such as the hemodialysis machine have helped treat illnesses that were previously lost causes. The development of knowledge-based products is also important for the preservation of the environment and protecting it from harmful matter such as industrial waste. It's hard to imagine what our lives would look like without these items. This time, we are going to venture through Yuan's knowledge-based productions. We will uncover who makes these products and why they are important to all industries in the country. We will also check out how the government is supporting knowledge-based companies in developing new advanced technologies. This time, our journey took us to the city of Apor in Zanjan province, where we visited Fanovaron Zistkore. This knowledge-based company was established nearly a decade ago and is active in three fields of laboratory work, research, and production of advanced machinery. The beating heart of this company is its advanced lab, which is trusted and certified by the National Environmental Protection Agency. Plus, it's part of the country's strategic technology lab network. Its labs are equipped with environmental monitoring technology as well as other instruments to carry out specialized research. Currently, its extensive lab cooperates closely with various industries, including hospitals in the field of environmental pollution monitoring, and acts as a research center for future innovations. This knowledge-based company provides many research services through its laboratories. For example, it previously carried out research projects in the field of oil refinery liquid waste. Another project was research on the treatment of synthetic resin sewage discharge using synthesized photocatalytic nanocomposites. These are used to gauge and remove pollutants in liquids for purification purposes. This company actively exchanges scientific information both nationally and internationally and regularly publishes its findings in academic journals at home and abroad. It collaborates with academic institutions and other research-based firms, providing them with test results. The government has been shifting more and more towards a knowledge-based economy that thrives on research. So knowledge spillover plays a big role in entrepreneurship, especially in cross-discipline research. Having labs in the country dedicated to advancing specialized research is very important. These types of knowledge-based companies help expand products in the market that may have been previously imported. It was the first company in the country to apply science for manufacturing wastewater treatment and purification. Its manufacturing workshops are massive, with a cumulative area of over a hectare to produce the giant water treatment systems. Its machinery is used in industrial settings where water is refined and returned to the system for reuse. Furthermore, its machinery has helped preserve valuable water resources nationwide. Some sectors that apply this technology are the food industry. In general, all industries that use water to produce their products are the end user of this company's water purification machinery. All of the technology produced here is manufactured along the lines of European standards. Its capabilities and products have been exported to regional areas, including Europe. As part of its future goals, this company wants to expand its product list and increase its exports. It's noteworthy that this company has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Among its staff, this company employs the capabilities of environmental engineers, among other experts, on its roster. Among its many competitive advantages, one can name the high-quality material that is used for productions of its water purification systems. But that's not all. This company has played a big role in creating technology that preserves all the fine qualities of water using advanced machines for purifications. Iran has been supporting the shift to a knowledge-based society by implementing plans that empower companies in their efforts to develop advanced technology. In fact, in 2010, the government passed laws promoting and supporting knowledge-based companies as part of a legal framework. This has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many social and economic advantages. In 2013, there were only 50 knowledge-based firms and startups. That figure has grown over the years to well over 6,000 companies, according to the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology. A diverse range of products is manufactured by these firms to meet the country's rising domestic demands. This has saved the country millions of dollars by reducing expensive imports. Iran makes thousands of different types of specialized technologies. The amount of progress of knowledge-based firms in the fields of medical devices, energy, and information communication technology is the most noticeable. Aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals are among other disciplines researchers are focusing on. And exports of knowledge-based products are estimated to reach over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's based on figures from the Science and Technology Office. The National Innovation Fund says tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. Some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market as well. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. Some of these schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports. Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups. High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries